if Moses was allowed to carry out his plan, Exton realized. And as Exton and Weinberg proceeded with their study, they realized that there was yet another, vastly more important natural asset that was going to be lost to the city: its waterfront. It didn't require much brains to see that running the highway in Riverside Park along the water would have the effect of making sure the waterfront itself could never be used for a park, Weinberg was to recall. It would forever eliminate, for recreational purposes, several miles of the most beautiful waterfront in the world. Except at scattered, difficult-to-reach locations, people would no longer be able to stroll beside the broad river, play beside it, fish in it, or picnic beside it. They would no longer be able even to look at it in peace. There would be a massive barrier of steel and concrete, and the roar of the motors of countless cars between the watcher and the water. There should be a highway through Riverside Park, agreed, but why could the highway not run where every other planner wanted it to run, atop the New York Central tracks that ran either up the center of the park or close to the slopes leading up to Riverside Drive? That would leave the rest of the park free for recreation, all the way down to the waterfront, as well as free from automobiles, and overpasses or underpasses could easily allow pedestrians to cross the highway to get to it. What lay between the two young reformers and Moses was partly a question of values. Moses had been formed in a different age, the age 20 years and more in the past, when he had been a young reformer. To understand his dream for the West Side improvement, one had to understand the age in which he had dreamed it. In that age, parks had been for the upper and comfortable middle classes, and one of the things those classes wanted most to do in parks was to drive through them, at the slow, leisurely speeds of the era, and enjoy their scenery. In that age, therefore, it made sense for a road through a park to be placed at its most scenic location, in the case of Riverside Park, at the river's edge. But things had changed. There had been 125,101 motor vehicles in New York City in 1914. There were 804,620 in New York City in 1934, and additional hundreds of thousands in the Westchester and New Jersey suburbs that would also pour cars onto the Henry Hudson Parkway. Heavy traffic on Moses Long Island parkways was already beginning to make driving on them less and less a source of pleasure and more a source of pain, or at least irritation. Their value as a source of beauty and pleasure in themselves was already clearly diminishing. At the same time, moreover, the need for providing and preserving other values was becoming more important. Cities were growing. Their people were being cut off more and more from nature. They needed every chance they could be given to see it and feel it around them. Recreation had been the key word among park enthusiasts when Moses had started building parks. Now, conservation was being heard more and more. In a New York in which concrete was devouring green grass and trees more hungrily every year, nothing was more necessary of conservation than the last piece of natural woodland on Manhattan, or a beautiful and unique swamp in Van Cortlandt Park, and its waterfront. Moreover, as Weinberg had pointed out, the highway was going to be, inevitably, a part of neighborhoods. The West Side improvement could give adjoining neighborhoods a priceless bounty, a great waterfront on which they could, without expense or travel, walk abroad and recreate themselves and their families. And if the river were ever cleansed of pollution, then this possibility should be considered, no matter how remote, for a public improvement such as Moses was proposing might well last for centuries, and anything could happen in centuries, they could swim in it, swim almost at their very doorstep, build a highway along that waterfront, erect huge viaducts of steel and pavements of concrete at the water's edge, and that waterfront would be gone, possibly forever, lost to the hungry city until the end of time. Build the West Side improvement to Robert Moses' specifications, and the city would undoubtedly gain in many ways, but it would lose in many ways, too, and it would lose in ways that could never be remedied. Moses might have seen these truths if he had been willing to listen to those who saw them so clearly. But he refused to listen, granting Exton only one interview, the one in which he was just sitting there laughing at you. Other city officials who listened to Exton and Weinberg didn't laugh. From the edge of the high bluff in Fort Tryon Park on the north side of the Cloisters, Comptroller McGoldrick could see Inwood Hill Park and the community of Spite and Dival spread out below to the north as clearly as if they had been parts of a diorama. With his eyes following Exton's pointing finger, McGoldrick could see at a glance how much lay in the path of Moses Root. Thickly forested slopes in the park, quiet residential streets in the community, and how little in the path of Exton's. He could see how little harm would be done to the park if a narrow band was sliced off its eastern edge for part of the right-of-way, and how the city street alongside the park would provide most of the rest. Across the river, beyond the northern terminus of the low-level bridge Exton wanted, below the built-up slopes of Spite and Dival to the left, there stretched dramatically straight north a valley occupied only by flimsy tar-paper shacks, a valley which might have been placed there as an ideal parkway right-of-way. Their route would have added maybe 3/4 of a mile, McGoldrick was to recall. But what's 3/4 of a mile to a motorist? A flick of the eye, that's all. And it would have saved the park and Riverdale and Fieldston from having a trench run through it. Some officials found flaws in Moses' plan that Exton and Weinberg hadn't thought of. Moses' ingeniously restrictive laws and ingeniously low-clearance parkway bridges had ensured that buses would never be able to ruin the beauty of his Long Island parkways or carry poor people along them to his state parks. The Board of Estimates chief engineer, Philip P. Farley, noticed that Moses was planning to low-bridge the city, too. Enough of his Henry Hudson Parkway bridges were going to have a maximum headroom of 13 feet and a headroom at the curb of 11 feet, so that usage of the parkway by buses, which were exactly 13 feet high, would be impractical. 1/3 of the families in the city have automobiles, Farley reported to the board. The other 2/3 depend on buses. If they are to get any benefit from this improvement, buses must use it. Moreover, while the principal function of Moses' Long Island parkways had been to enable drivers to reach state parks, the principal function of the Henry Hudson Parkway would be to enable drivers from the Bronx and Westchester to commute to their jobs in Manhattan. His earlier roads had been roads for pleasure, but this would be a road for business. Without buses, commuting on it could only be by car. This might well prove impractical. Not only would the parkway increase the flow of cars into traffic-clogged Manhattan, but, with the inevitable increase in the population of Spite and Dival, Riverdale, and Westchester, car traffic might well overwhelm the parkway. In some future generation, opening it to buses each able to carry 40 or more car drivers might well become imperative. But, as Farley said, the normal life of the parkway bridges is estimated at 100 years. Rebuilding them after the parkway itself had been completed would be enormously expensive. One of the 13-foot bridges, the one at 239th Street, was by design the centerpiece of a large traffic interchange, all of which would have to be rebuilt at a cost of millions of dollars. If Moses was allowed to build low bridges, even if the city might in some future generation want to allow buses on the Henry Hudson Parkway, it might simply be financially impractical to do so. But Moses wouldn't listen to the city's officials. When McGoldrick tried to talk to him about the alternate route, he cut the comptroller short. He would brook no change, McGoldrick recalls. It had to be straight. When Farley recommended that the board disapprove the bridge designs, Moses called the recommendation absurd in the light of the law, the parkway law he had written, of course, and told the board flatly that if the bridges weren't built his way, they would not be built at all. The old reformers who headed the city's good government organizations were products of an earlier era, many of them of the same era as Moses, but they were willing to listen to the two young reformers, and, listening, they were convinced. Once the board of the Municipal Art Society had a debate, Exton recalls, it took a view that Moses was ruining Inwood Hill. Old Electus D. Litchfield, a great and good architect, said what a beautiful view there was from the road. I said that from the road there is a beautiful view, but to the road there is a lousy view. And I still remember some of the old-time architects and Beaux-Arts boys who were on that board saying, "Hear, hear." Soon, the Citizens Union, the City Club, and the Regional Plan Association were all asking for a detailed examination of Moses' proposal. Moses stopped laughing. He wrote a letter to the trustees of the City Club charging that the two men were pushing the alternate route because it would increase the value of Weinberg's Spuytendyvil real estate. "There was no truth in what he said, none at all," Exton recalls. "Bob did own some real estate in Spuytendyvil, but it was a small property he had inherited from his parents, really insignificant when compared to other property he had inherited. He was quite wealthy, you know. And the property was undeveloped and near the route Moses wanted. If the parkway was put along Moses' route, it, the property, would have become quite valuable. Our route would have left it just as it was. Its value would have been increased by Moses' route, not ours. And Moses must have known that the alternate route wouldn't have done what he was saying it would, increase the value of Weinberg's property. It was obvious, but he said it anyway. His only reply to everything we had proposed was an ad hominem attack on us, and it was all a lie, a goddamned lie." City Club President Eustace Seligman called Exton in, questioned him about the charge, and then told the trustees that he was completely satisfied as to the young men's integrity. The City Club Park Committee thereupon accompanied Exton to the high bluff at the Cloisters, and saw, as McGoldrick had seen, the advantages of the alternate route. And when Moses refused even to grant the committee an interview, it issued a report, notable in that it was the first formal censure of Moses by any of the good government organizations that had long supported him, that called his plan a violation of the principles of good planning. "While we are for Mr. Moses as a man, having bent over backward in our efforts to get the order, Order Number 129, of Secretary Ickes rescinded, his treatment here is high-handed and not in the best interests of the public," the report said. Other good government groups that investigated the West Side improvement also agreed with Exton and Weinberg. The RPA even commissioned engineers to map out the alternate route. But the reformers' front was far from solid. The logical group to lead a protest about park plans was the Park Association, and the president of the Park Association was Mrs. Sulzberger, and Jack Madigan was telling Mrs. Sulzberger that Inwood Hill was used only for necking. And in the middle of the fight, Mrs. Sulzberger sent Moses a letter, which, while not specifically mentioning the West Side improvement, said that the association had reviewed the many developments which are taking place in the parks under your energetic leadership, and decided that we ought to express to you officially our approval and delight in what you are doing. Even the City Club's board of directors ended up disowning its park committee's report, despite a statement by Director Nathan Strauss noting that every organization that has studied the project has agreed that the lower route is the only practical one. He accused Moses of treating city parks as if they were his own private property. Those reformers who still objected found that the powers they had been so instrumental in persuading LaGuardia and the legislature to give Moses were now turned against them. They appealed to the Board of Estimate to stop the park commissioner from chopping down the trees in Inwood Hill Park, but then remembered with a shock that under the Park Department Consolidation Act, which they had supported, in violation of their own stated principles, the board had no authority over the details of work within parks. Since Moses was not using city money for the work, moreover, he did not need board approval for any work in Inwood Hill. Then they demanded that Moses hold a public hearing on his plans and threatened to file a taxpayer's suit to obtain an injunction if he did not agree to hold one. Moses agreed. He set a date 2 weeks away, and then, during those 2 weeks, he cut down hundreds of trees for the right-of-way. "He knew how to handle them," Madigan would laugh years later, recalling the reformers' shock when they realized that the park they had wanted so much to save had been ruined. Moses himself regarded his move as a masterstroke. He devoted space in his memoirs to relating how his men invented a new ingenious tree-pulling device equipped with a sort of electric donkey engine that cut down trees even faster than he had hoped. The Board of Estimate did have power over the Riverside Park section of the project because, despite the federal and state contributions, the city would have to furnish much of the money itself. Borough President Samuel Levy of Manhattan proposed preserving the waterfront for pedestrians by building the Henry Hudson Parkway not along the water, but over the New York Central tracks. Moses replied by driving stakes. Starting work in Riverside Park on the recreational facilities the public wanted, he asked the board if they wanted the work wasted. He whipsawed the board. He announced publicly that his plans were not only ready, but approved by the federal government, which was prepared to give the city millions of dollars for them. If the board accepted Levy's proposal, he said, new plans would have to be drawn up. That would take months. Then the plans might or might not gain federal approval. Even if they did, federal money might no longer be available. The city should not risk losing the chance of a century to get the job done. He misinformed the board. He told it at one point that Levy's plan would cost $34 million, while his would cost only $6 million. It actually was to cost the city four times that amount. He deluged the board with attractively printed brochures showing the beauty of his plan. He invoked experience and past successes. When Levy tried to argue for an impartial engineering survey of the two plans, Moses said, "The problem is primarily for park, parkway, and landscape experts, and not one of simple engineering." And he reminded the board that his men were park, parkway, and landscape experts who had built Jones Beach. Levy was certain that his plan would not cost $34 million, and he was certain that Moses would cost far more than $6 million. But without enough technically proficient engineers to cost out Moses' plans, without press support, not only did the press accept Moses' figures as truth, it did not even discuss at length such issues as waterfront preservation. With LaGuardia against him, because the mayor wanted the West Side improvement built before November 1937, when he would be running for re-election, and exerting pressure on the board members, the borough president was helpless. Hardly had he completed an acerbic exchange with Moses. "Moses, do you think you know more about building parkways than I do?" Levy, "I didn't say so." Moses, "Well, this is a parkway." When the board approved Moses' plan. If there was any desire for second thoughts, there wasn't time for them. The very day after approval was given, huge pile drivers were hammering bulkheads into the Hudson River off the shore of Riverside Park. Within a week, convoys of dump trucks, 500 a day, were rumbling over the dirt roads leading into the park. 6,000 WPA-paid laborers were shoveling into place the rock and earth the trucks were delivering and pouring over them cement that would harden into a new shoreline for Manhattan Island. Progress on the Henry Hudson Bridge was just as rapid. By the time the board got around to considering whether the Bronx route should go through Spuyten Duyvil, its approval was required for that because its money was required for the condemnation necessary there, the northern bridgeheads were fixed in place, in Spuyten Duyvil. There was no choice but to approve the Spuyten Duyvil route. And Moses did not let the pace slacken. The speed with which the West Side improvement was driven to completion was symbolized by the construction of the bridge that carried the Henry Hudson Parkway over Broadway at 253rd Street in Riverdale, a job that would normally have taken at least a year to complete. The legislation authorizing construction of the bridge by the State Council of Parks was signed at 1 p.m. May 1, 1935. At 5 p.m. that same day, Moses opened bids on the job and let the contract. At 7 a.m. the next morning, laborers were working on the site. One midnight a few weeks later, while most Riverdalians were asleep, the 6 7-foot-wide steel spans that would hold the roadbed of the bridge rumbled up Broadway on huge flat floats pulled by tractors, and at 5:55 a.m., the last rivet securing them in place over Broadway was set. When Riverdalians went to work in the morning, there before them was a bridge where none had existed the night before. Moses' reluctance to discuss his plans for the northern section of the West Side Improvement was understandable. He could not, after all, tell Exton and Weinberg the real reasons he wanted the approach to the Henry Hudson Bridge to be through Inwood Hill Park instead of along the street at its edge. If word ever leaked out that a 6-lane highway was being classified as a park access road, the CWA and WPA would have to reclassify the project. Moses could not explain to Exton and Weinberg that while it might be better to build the bridge on a lower level near the existing drawbridge and therefore avoid Inwood Hill Park and Spuyten Duyvil, his idea of the proper location didn't matter. Only the bankers' ideas mattered, because it was the bankers who had to put up the money for the bridge. Moses could not, in fact, allow any discussion of the bridge location at all, because discussion generates controversy, and controversy frightens away the timid, and no one is more timid than a banker where his money is concerned. The market was so skittish that any little thing could have gotten them to back out, Jack Madigan recalls. A lesser fellow wouldn't have understood the importance of killing off this agitation right at the start before it began raising up some publicity and getting people arguing. But Moses understood perfectly. The financing of the northern section of the West Side Improvement had been made possible only by remarkable ingenuity on Moses' part, an ingenuity that bent rules and regulations, twisted them, in fact, until they were all but unrecognizable, into a shape that permitted the participation in the financing of the project of bankers and 22 separate city, state, and federal agencies. Exposure of that ingenuity to the public would tumble in an instant the house of cards he had so laboriously erected. He could not allow it. And what good would discussion do anyway? The city had been trying to build the West Side Improvement for decades, generations in fact. It had never, even in the free-spending Walkerian era, been able to find the funds to do the job. It could only be done now because of the federal relief program, and that program might be curtailed at any time. If the job was ever to be done, it had to be done at once, without delay. Discussion meant delay, and therefore discussion could not be permitted. There was no alternative, see? No alternative, Madigan says. Madigan's statement was not accurate. There was an alternative. It just was not an alternative that he, or Robert Moses, would even consider. There might be no alternative if the bridge had to be built immediately. But why did it have to be built immediately? If the bankers refused to finance its construction unless it was located on the escarpment, a location which required the destruction of Inwood Hill Park and Spuyten Duyvil, why was it necessary to accept their terms? The city could simply refuse them and wait until it could build the bridge itself, in the place where it should be built. And it might not have too long to wait. The situation now was significantly different from the past. Construction of the approach roads was, thanks to Moses, well underway at last, to the south from the Battery to 193rd Street, just a mile from the Harlem River, to the north all the way down through Westchester and into the city down to 249th Street, a point only about a mile from the river. More than 16 miles of the through route was under construction. Only 2 miles, including the bridge, remained to be built. This was no longer a project not begun. It was a project largely completed. With LaGuardia in City Hall, the city's government had the will to complete it. With more than 90% of the cost already paid, moreover, this was no longer a project whose cost was $109 million. It was a project whose cost, the cost of its uncompleted 2 miles, including bridge, was less than $10 million. The city might not have $10 million to spare at the moment, but it was not unrealistic to suspect that, with LaGuardia running city finances with an iron hand, it might have it someday, someday soon, as in fact was going to be the case. By 1936, the city had sufficient leeway in its capital budget to build the bridge itself. Such an alternative might well have appealed to Exton and Weinberg. There was an immediate need for the bridge, of course, and there was a risk in delaying its construction, the risk that the city's financial position might worsen, or its will to do the job might fade, and the bridge would never be built. But such risks had to be weighed against the certainties entailed in construction of the bridge at the point the bankers wanted, the destruction of Manhattan's priceless last forest and of Riverdale's priceless serenity. Weighing the risks, Exton and Weinberg might well have decided on delay. The city, represented by its elected officials, might have so decided too. But such considerations did not weigh more than a feather on Robert Moses' private scales, unbalanced as they were by his desire for accomplishment, for achievement, for the tangible, physical realization of his dreams. For such dreams, as the man who echoed his thoughts, Jack Madigan, put it, money is all. Now, at last, after 2 decades of dreaming of the West Side improvement, he had the money for it, and he was not about to let that money slip away. "Yeah, I remember that," Madigan would say 30 years later when asked about the Exton-Weinberg proposal, and the hard, quiet voice would be filled with contempt and disgust. "I remember that as an asinine idea, brother." Robert Moses did not give the city a chance to decide. The Henry Hudson Bridge opened on December 12, 1936. The opening ceremony, which Moses combined with a birthday party for LaGuardia, was not one of the park commissioner's more successful productions. A sudden wild rainstorm forced the celebrants to crowd into the tiny administrative building on the bridge toll plaza, into which the bar had hastily been moved, and fierce gusts of wind kept blowing open the windows and dampening the spirits. King Edward VIII picked the same day for his announcement that he was giving up his throne for the woman I love, and the mayor insisted, to Moses' rage, on interrupting the ceremonies to listen to a rebroadcast of the abdication speech. In the evening, the rain stopped, the skies cleared, and Moses, taking Jack Madigan along, drove down to the shoreline below the bridge to view his handiwork by moonlight. Staring up at the slender arch flung across the gap between the 2 high bluffs, he was struck by its grace. But even this moment was spoiled for him, for the blunt Irishman was not the ideal moonlight companion. When Moses started rhapsodizing about the beauty of the scene, Cleveland Rogers relates, Madigan said that all he could think about was the dimes rattling in the toll boxes. Nothing, however, could dim Moses' pride in the fulfillment of the great dream of his youth. When, on October 12, 1937, in time for Election Day, the whole West Side improvement was completed, he commandeered Madigan's yacht and ordered its captain to stand out into the Hudson so that he could view his creation in its full sweep. From the deck of a ferry boat in the middle of the river 20 years before, the 6 miles of Riverside Park had been 6 miles of garbage dumps and mud, of tar paper shacks and stacks of rotting timbers, all shrouded in the dirty gray smoke spewed up by the trains that clanked everlastingly through it. Yet he had exclaimed to the woman beside him, "Isn't this a temptation to you? Couldn't this be the most beautiful thing in the world?" Now he felt that it very nearly was. The tracks were gone from the whole lower stretch of the park. So were the mud and the shacks and the garbage. In their place were the things he had seen only in his mind then, the great highway that went uptown along the water, and the lush park beside it. From the river, the massive retaining walls trimmed with granite and marble, set with loopholes and embrasures, stretching for miles along the water, rising one behind the other up to Riverside Drive, were battlements, a fortification protecting the great city behind it. The loom from Riverside Drive behind the battlements, not only of the sheer brick wall of apartment houses, but of the turrets and watchtowers of mansions that resembled medieval castles, the central facade of Charles M. Schwab's, which occupied the square block between 73rd and 74th Streets, was reminiscent of the Chateau of Chenonceau, the wings of the castles of Blois and Azay-le-Rideau. The presence behind the battlements of the columns and cannons of the Soldiers and Sailors Monument, erected to honor warriors of a civil war, and farther north, of the massive granite sepulchre of the great general who had led them, the image, life-sized in the distance, of a girl warrior out of the 15th century, the bronze mount of the Maid of Orleans rearing at 93rd Street from a pedestal set with fragments from Reims Cathedral, where she waited trial and death, the upthrust of spires out of the 13th century, the spires of Riverside Church that were modeled on the cathedral at Chartres, the stark outline atop a bluff to the north of the simple square watchtower of the medieval monastery of Saint-Michel de Cuza that was now called the Cloisters. These only made more complete the effect for which Moses had been striving, that of a wall built to guard a city as walls had guarded cities during the Middle Ages, specifically the German cities, whose walls, along with those of the medieval fortress castles of the Raubritter, or robber barons, had lined the Rhine and fired Moses' imagination when, as a romantic young student, he had so often cruised that river. Not that the West Side improvement was just a fortification, of course. It was far more than that. Along its lowest level, at the edge of the water, were lines of moving vehicles, and, once one realized they were part of the improvement, one saw that to call it medieval was to slight it. The towering battlements were combined with an entranceway to the city, an entranceway whose Riverside Park portion alone was 6 miles long, an entranceway framed in marble and granite and flanked by the tombs of dead heroes, an entranceway of a size and grandeur that could only be Roman, a via triumphalis, like those along which had ridden the conquering generals of the empire on their way to receive the laurel wreath from the Caesar. A fortification? An entranceway? The West Side improvement was also a park, a lovely park. The retaining walls formed a series of terraces rising from the water, and the terraces were lush, green, tree-shaded lawns. Through the shadows of the arches of the 79th Street boat basin, one could see a fountain splashing coolly. If the West Side improvement was grandeur, it was also beauty. The scene was just as Robert Moses had envisioned it 20 years before, even to the bright white sails of the boats tied up in the gracefully curving marinas. Moses was more than satisfied with his handiwork. The sheer cliffs of the forest-topped palisades, opposite the sheer cliffs of Manhattan's apartment houses, were the most magnificent river wall anywhere, he felt, and the wall he had created was its match. Now that it was completed, the Hudson Vista was the greatest river vista in the world. The Rhine? The Rhine with its silly, quaint Wagnerian castles? Thanks to the West Side improvement, the Hudson absolutely dwarfed the Rhine. Penning an introduction to a brochure describing the improvement, he sounded like the Bob Moses of his youth. This, then, is the Hudson waterfront celebrated by Masefield and O'Neill, where the fabled liners and cargo vessels thrust their prows into the very vitals of the city. Tycoons overlook the upper and lower bays and the Jersey piers. Droves of cars zoom or crawl through Riverside Park and down the West Side Highway and view the matchless, unspoiled palisades. By comparison, the castled Rhine with its Lorelei is a mere trickle between vine-clad slopes. I wonder sometimes whether our people, so obsessed with the seamy interior of Manhattan, deserve the Hudson. What a waterfront! What an island to buy for $24! The city's pride matched Moses. The reporters chauffeured over the improvement before its opening to the public were all too familiar with the previous route into New York from the north, the wearisome stop-and-go gear-shifting over the narrow, bumpy streets of Yonkers, a traffic light on every corner to increase the irritation, the trip through the Bronx down a Broadway made dismal and dingy by the small stores and grimy tenements that lined it, and by the shadows and harsh rumbles of the IRT elevated tracks overhead. They, like other drivers, had to wonder as they approached the Broadway drawbridge whether they would be in for an interminable delay there. And when they crossed the bridge, they had to resume the crawl downtown on Riverside Drive or Broadway in endless lines of traffic. The approaches to New York had been agonizingly slow and ugly as well. a mean and meager entrance to a great city. Now they skimmed down to New York along the broad Sawmill River Parkway, all sweeping curves and spacious straightaways, lined with woods, underbrushy and shadowy and deep, that drenched them in autumn colors, and with clearings in which black boulders sat dramatically in the center of sun-dappled grass. The bridges that carried intersecting traffic over the parkway so that its users should not be disturbed were little Moses masterpieces, each faced with stone carefully selected to blend in with nearby rock formations, each subtly different in design from any other, mere hints in the midst of a natural setting of the shaping hand of man, mere hints of what the parkway was carrying them towards. Yonkers was just something off beyond the trees. Slopes shielded motorists from even a glimpse of that unlovely municipality until the parkway had almost reached the Bronx Line, where its name changed from Sawmill River to Henry Hudson. The signs announcing the change were made gay by cartoon silhouettes done in wrought iron of Hudson's half moon. And while at that point there was an unavoidable minute or two of small houses visible atop the slope, the parkway ducked quickly into the shelter of Van Cortlandt Park and was back among trees and grass again. It was not until Van Cortlandt was behind the reporters that houses became a permanent part of the scenery, and then they were at first only on one, the right or river side of the road, and they were at first just small private homes, fieldstone covered, for this was Riverdale. No more than another hint, just slightly broader than the bridges, of what was to come. Flashing through Riverdale toward the steep cliffs of the Harlem River, the hints became broader still. The private homes flanking the parkway on both sides now, crowding closer to it and closer together, three low apartment houses becoming part of the scene in Spite and Dival, but there were still plenty of trees and grass. Leaping the Harlem on the Henry Hudson Bridge, the reporters saw the Broadway Bridge far below them to the left, and beyond it, a glimpse of the city. But the glimpse, cut short by the approaching bluffs of Inwood Hill, was fleeting, and the city was hazy in the distance and hundreds of feet below them, and the bluffs were towering and filled with trees, and while the parkway might be in the city now, it was not yet of the city. Leaving the bridge toll booths, the parkway curved abruptly to the right, down and around a great craggy bluff that towered above it, and even that fleeting glimpse was gone, and what was in front of the reporters as their car passed through the bluff's deep shadow was only trees, and, seen through the trees, a bright river, and beyond the river, the Palisades. And then they were around the curve, and there was New York. First, there was steelwork and concrete in the sky, immense towers, thick cables, a roadbed above the water, the George Washington Bridge looming above the leaves, casting a dark shadow over the parkway so that the reporter's limousine rolled across it as if it were a gigantic welcome mat to a gigantic city. Then, above the parkway to the left, there were apartment houses behind the leaves. And suddenly, the city was beside the reporters, looming over them. Atop the great cliffs of rock were cliffs of brick, the massed apartment houses of Riverside Drive. Far away to the left, there were the spires of the Empire State Building and the Chrysler Building, their very visibility at such a distance an evocation of the immensity of the canyons of skyscrapers toward which the limousine was headed. Ahead of the reporters was the panorama of the harbor, serene water turned busy, churned by the giant screws of giant ships, dented by piers jutting out from shore. If there was drama in this entrance to the city, there was, even within the city's confines, beauty too, and dignity. As the limousine headed downtown toward the reporters' offices, the parkway hugged the river's edge, and the water was broad on the road's right hand. The palisades across the river stayed largely unspoiled for precious minutes. Between the parkway and the apartment houses to the left were the terraces Moses had built and planted with trees and lawn, and the retaining walls of the terraces, the walls that flanked the parkway, were masonry and marble, and their copings were of granite, and above on Riverside Drive were Grant's tomb and the Soldiers and Sailors Monument, friezes and colonnades. And even when there was no more beauty or dignity, there was still convenience. When the Henry Hudson Parkway became the West Side Elevated Highway, and there were no more trees or terraces, and the Jersey Shore, what could be seen of it through a dense industrial haze, was a panorama of all that was wrong with the industrial era, and the view to the left, toward the city, was of railroad yards and warehouses and traffic-jammed streets, the reporters could still realize that they were not on those streets, that they were speeding downtown without having even to pause. The reporters rhapsodized. "The most beautiful drive in the world," wrote one from the Daily News. "Always the man in the car has the river in full view," marveled one from the Times. Simeon Strunsky said in Topics of the Times, "The West Side Highway as a name utterly fails to do justice to the new masterpiece out of Robert Moses' atelier. The traveler comes and goes in a setting of beauty which it is not too much to call intoxicating." Strunsky was also to write, "The poet Wordsworth stood on Waterloo Bridge and said about the Thames view that earth had no finer sight. But Wordsworth should have stood at the north end of the Henry Hudson Bridge and looked south and west." Moses had promised that the new road would eliminate the West Side's north-south traffic jams. He announced that the trip from Canal Street to the city line, which had previously required 68 minutes, would henceforth take only 26. And none of the journalists had the slightest doubt that Moses was correct. "It is a veritable motorist's dream," said the Journal American. The Times marveled that "the gleaming new concrete ribbon would not only afford immediate and measurable relief to traffic congestion on Riverside Drive, but would enable motorists to drive all the way from Canal Street nearly to Poughkeepsie without having to stop for a traffic light or slow up for an intersection." And journalists understood that Moses' project was not just a view or a road. "The West Side improvement is much more than that," the Sun editorialized. "It gives the island not only a new major highway and a new shoreline along part of its length, but parkland and playgrounds." The Journal American said it provided "a fountain of health and pleasure from which New York's people and their children and guests will be drinking long years to come." The Brooklyn Eagle emphasized that "after decades of fruitless effort, the railroad tracks are covered at last." In fact, said the Times, "all that has been unsightly along the Hudson, the railroad, the ash dumps, the coal yards, has been swept away or completely disguised." The statistics in the thick packets of press releases that Moses' men handed to the reporters were, even to men accustomed to press releases filled with statistics, almost too big to grasp. To create the Riverside Park portion of his dream alone, Robert Moses had poured into the 6 miles of muddy wasteland 1,250,000 cubic yards of stone riprap, 3 million cubic yards of hydraulic fill, 296,400 linear feet of steel and concrete piling, 6,800,000 pounds of reinforcing steel, 1,912,000 bags of cement, 120,000 pounds of lead, 12,500 cubic yards of stone masonry, 1,600 cubic yards of granite, and 220,000 cubic yards of topsoil and humus. But the reporters did their best to make the city grasp them. They pointed out that, as the Times put it, Moses had, in the most extensive alteration of Manhattan's topography in recent history, put a highway through an already overcrowded park with a substantial gain, instead of a loss, of recreational space. A gain that amounted to the incredible total of 132 acres, an addition to the land area of crowded Manhattan Island, worth, at current land values, $23,760,000. They pointed out that he had filled that space with 15 tennis courts, 17 playgrounds, 23 softball fields, 38 basketball courts, 40 handball courts, 13,000 trees, 140,000 feet of footpaths, and 350,000 shrubs. The most incredible statistic of all was not included in the press release. That was the cost of Moses' dream. His press releases stated that the cost was $24 million, but this figure bears no discernible relationship to reality, since even the most cursory examination of the cost, all that is possible since Moses took care never to reveal it, and its components are concealed in such a multitude of appropriations, citywide property assessments, borough property assessments, special board of estimate appropriations, and federal contributions from 22 separate sources that 37 years later it is unfeasible to attempt to compute them, reveals that the total cost of the West Side improvement, including the elevated highway, was at least $180 million, and perhaps as high as $218 million, an immense figure in Depression dollars. The famous Boulder Dam, always cited as an example of spectacular New Deal expenditures, cost $76 million. But New York's press did not attempt to analyze the cost, accepting instead Moses' $24 million figure and coupling it with the comment that for this expenditure, the city had received in return land worth $23,760,000. Out of 13 daily newspapers, not one had the slightest doubt that the West Side improvement was anything but an improvement, an unalloyed improvement, an absolutely unmitigated blessing to New York City. Not a dissenting voice could be heard. One can search in vain through the city's newspapers during the weeks in 1937 in which articles on the improvement were appearing daily, looking for a single hint, even a buried quote in a story or a lone letter to the editor, suggesting that there was the slightest imperfection in the project. "The railroad tracks are covered at last," an editorial said. "Not exactly." The railroad tracks were covered until they reached 125th Street, the beginning of Harlem. Moses had decided to economize on the section of the West Side improvement between 125th and 155th Streets that bordered the city's Negro community, and one of the economies was dispensing with the track covering in that section. Uncovered tracks meant a never-ending clanking from the couplings of railroad cars and periodic bawling from the cows and other animals being transported south to the slaughterhouses, unless the people who lived in the apartments above kept their windows closed. And in the summer, when it was too hot to keep windows closed, uncovered tracks meant not only noise but odors, the stench of the animals, and they meant soot and smoke that spread a coat of gritty grime, confined to windowsills in winter, over walls and furniture. Now, thanks to the genius of Robert Moses, the white people who lived along Riverside Drive were freed from these annoyances. But the black people weren't. Robert Moses spent millions of dollars enlarging Riverside Park through landfill, but he did not spend a dime for that purpose between 125th and 155th Streets. He added 132 acres to the parts of the park most likely to be used by white people, but not 1 acre to the part of the park most likely to be used by black people. Robert Moses ruthlessly removed all commercial enterprises from the waterfront along the entire 6-mile length of Riverside Park, except for those commercial enterprises, wharves, small warehouses, coal pockets, junkyards, and the like, that were located in the Harlem section of Riverside Park. Those he allowed to remain, to occupy what otherwise would have been parkland for Harlem. Because he did not enlarge Riverside Park in the Harlem section, there was, really, for two-thirds of the Harlem section, the stretch between 125th and 145th Streets, no Riverside Park at all. The green of lawns and trees that he laid out with such a lavish hand south of Harlem ends abruptly at 125th Street, and the only green that remains is a very narrow, very steep, treed slope, too steep for anything except slipping and sliding down it, that, for some of those 20 blocks, climbs from the uncovered tracks to Riverside Drive above. Except for that little ribbon of trees, pathetic when compared to the lush lawns and lavish plantings downtown, the park is, for these 20 blocks, only the grim steel of the tracks and the gray concrete of the parkway. Robert Moses devoted endless ingenuity to making the Henry Hudson Parkway beautiful in and of itself. From 72nd to 125th Street, for example, he lined the roadway with trees and shrubs and faced the walls along its sides with granite and marble and expensive masonry. But between 125th and 145th Streets, he lifted the roadway into the air on a gaunt steel viaduct. There is not a tree or shrub on the viaduct. There is not a foot of granite or marble or masonry. The only ornamentation whatsoever on the starkly ugly steel is the starkly ugly cheap concrete aggregate with which it is paved. And the viaduct is not only unlovely in and of itself, it makes the waterfront over which it runs even uglier than it was before, filling its streets with its shadows and the never-ending rumble of the cars that travel along it. And its presence ensures that even should New York City one day decide to give those 20 blocks of Harlem what it has given most of the other residential neighborhoods along the Hudson River, a park below Riverside Drive, the park will have to be one filled with shadow and noise. There is at least one spot in this 20-block stretch at which it would have been easy to create a park, even without landfill operations. At the foot of 125th and 126th Streets, these mean and narrow thoroughfares slope down and, after running under Moses Viaduct, run right out into a broad wharf that juts out into the river, so that turning it into a park would have made the riverfront a part of Harlem. Of the whole Hudson River waterfront, no area was more intimately a part of the adjoining community and more suitable to be a park for it. Moses might not have wanted to spend much money on the Harlem section of the West Side improvement, but a park here would not have cost much money. Condemning the wharf would have been cheap, as would also have been placing playground facilities on it to give the children of the neighborhood a chance to play right on the river, or laying earth and sod on it to bring a touch of brightness to a neighborhood without brightness. And seeing the park possibilities of the wharf was easy. In fact, it would have been hard not to, for on every sunny day it was crowded with people fishing, staring out over the water, or washing their cars in the sun. But somehow Moses didn't see. He never made a move to turn the 125th Street wharf into a park, and in 1974 it would still be standing vacant, a monument to a city's indifference to the needs of its poorest people. Harlem does, of course, have a section of Riverside Park, the section between 145th Street, where the Henry Hudson Parkway swings down off the viaduct, and 155th Street, a stretch of land 10 blocks long, plenty long enough to provide the playgrounds, ball fields, and other facilities that a recreation-starved community so desperately needed. Robert Moses built 17 playgrounds as part of the West Side improvement. He built one playground in the Harlem section of the improvement. He built 5 football fields as part of the improvement. He built one in the Harlem section. He built 18 horseshoe courts, 22 tennis courts, half a mile of roller skating paths, and a mile of bicycle paths in the rest of the improvement. He did not build a single horseshoe or tennis court or a foot of roller skating or bicycle path in the Harlem portion. When the improvement first opened, in fact, there was not a single recreational facility of any type in the entire Harlem section, not so much as a stanchion with a basketball hoop attached. The initial plans Moses had distributed to newspapers when he was persuading LaGuardia to approve the improvement had shown a recreational area between 146th and 148th Streets on the riverside of the parkway. But while most of the recreational areas above and below Harlem were completed when the improvement opened, the 146th Street, 148th Street area was not even begun. He did move thereafter to build it, hurriedly, because, according to one report, LaGuardia suddenly realized the omission and insisted it be rectified, and Moses was afraid the mayor would make it public. But its pitifully inadequate and cheaply built facilities proved remarkably difficult to reach from the community it was supposed to serve. The only way to reach it on foot from Harlem, in fact, was by walking to Riverside Drive, walking down an incredibly long flight of steps to the New York Central tracks, crossing the tracks on a footbridge, which meant climbing up another flight of steps to get on it and climbing down a flight to get off, and then walking down another flight of steps to an underpass under the parkway which led to the recreational area. And reaching it was downhill. Getting back up to Riverside Drive was uphill. On even pleasant summer afternoons, the recreational area Moses had so generously bestowed upon Harlem would be almost empty, except for motorists from other areas who found it remarkably accessible. Just pull off the parkway and there you were, by car. Robert Moses had always displayed a genius for adorning his creations with little details that made them fit in with their setting, that made the people who used them feel at home in them. There was a little detail on the Playhouse Comfort Station in the Harlem section of Riverside Park that is found nowhere else in the park. The wrought iron trellises of the park's other playhouses and comfort stations are decorated with designs like curling waves. The wrought iron trellises of the Harlem Playhouse Comfort Station are decorated with monkeys. Robert Moses had reclaimed the city's waterfront for its people, an editorial said. Not exactly. Robert Moses had indeed built a huge, beautiful riverside park. But the park was not on the riverside. The parkway was on the riverside. For much of the 6 miles of Riverside Park, the road, not the park, occupied the land nearest to the river. And that meant that the park and the people who used it were separated from the river by 6 lanes of concrete filled with rushing automobiles. If Moses had built the road where other planners and young reformers like Bill Exton and Robert Weinberg had wanted it built, atop the New York Central tracks, at the edge of Riverside Park, close to the steep slope below Riverside Drive, the city's people would, after strolling down from the drive and crossing the road on easy overpasses, have found themselves in a park whose tree-shaded lawns, playing fields, and esplanades swept hundreds of yards down to the river's edge, unbroken by the concrete of a highway or the rush and smells of automobiles. Because the park would have extended to the Hudson's edge, they would have been able to picnic or play, or simply sit on benches and think, at the very edge of a broad and beautiful river. They would have been able, on the very rim of the city, to escape the city, and to escape it completely. But Moses had chosen, in much of Riverside Park, to build the road at the water's edge. And therefore, in much of the park, its users were hardly conscious that there was any river there at all. From much of Riverside Park, in fact, they could hardly see the water. Robert Moses placed in Riverside Park 5,500 benches, offering, he said, fine views of the river. But from most of those benches, the river is hardly visible. They are placed at the same level as the highway, and above the highway barrier wall, only a thin sliver of water can be seen. Near 96th Street, for example, there are hundreds of benches, in long, neat rows, facing the river. But all you can see from the benches is the barrier wall, the tops of cars speeding past behind it, and the very edge of the Hudson on the New Jersey side. From some of the 5,500 benches, you can see all of the river, but always there are cars, a fierce, never-ending rush of them, long lines of them, cars with their hurry and noise and smell, in front of that river. There are always cars in front of the river in Riverside Park. In place of great parks and terraces and promenades, Peter Blake was to write in the 1960s, we have built, along almost every single foot of the coastline of this city, gigantic viaducts of steel and concrete that carry streams of automobiles and effectively block our views of the water, a passing steamer, a seagull, or possibly a sunrise. Always the man in the car has the river in full view, wrote a newspaper man. That was true. But to give the man in the car that view, fleeting at best and harried, to let him enjoy a brief glimpse of beauty as he passed by it, hurriedly and with his mind on other things, Moses had taken it away from the man not in the car, the pedestrian walking beside the river or sitting beside it, picnicking or just looking at it, soaking it in for long minutes and hours, the man who would have had time to enjoy and savor the view, the man whose life could have been enriched by it. He had thought that by building a road along the waterfront, he was giving the beauty and openness of the waterfront, as he had given the beauty and openness of Long Island, to both the city's cars and the city's people. But he was wrong. It was no longer possible to do both. In building the West